right now, Nick should be diving into 6 feet underwater to practice swimming for the Olympics, the 2020 Olympics. Instead, he's 6 feet underground. There's nothing that can be done to change that. Carmen Shenchup should be decorating her dorm right now. Jamie should be dancing, you know, and Nick should be swimming. These kids and were our friends, and not to mention the staff that we lost as well. They were our friends. We knew them really well. It's a really difficult time because, you know, I saw Nick the day before and we said hi in the halls, and I saw Coach Feist that morning. You know, you have to make sure that you talk to your loved ones and your friends. You make sure that they know you love them and you appreciate them, because you never know when you may never get to say hi to them again.
Parkland shooting survivor Spencer Blum remembering his friends 1 year after they were killed at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. 14 students and 3 staff members died that day. At the time, it became just the latest incident in 2 decades of school shootings. With each one, you might feel a sense of grief, loss, outrage. And for those who want to control access to guns, also a flickering of hope that this might be the moment when things change. The cycle of horror and anti-gun activism all started with a shooting in Columbine, Colorado. And then another one just a few months later in the most suburban of suburbs, Granada Hills, here in the San Fernando Valley. Today, KCRW reporter David Weinberg takes us back to August 10th, 1999, when a gunman drove to a Jewish community center day camp there and opened fire.
After the shootings at Columbine High School and the Granada Hills Jewish Community Center, millions of Americans saw images on the news of white suburban kids fleeing in terror from gunmen. Up until that point, America's gun violence epidemic was largely seen as an inner-city problem that primarily affected people of color. Donna Deese Thomas's was one of the many suburban moms who watched the news the day of the Granada Hills shooting. This is a clip from a video of Thomas's talking about her reaction.
I was taken aback because these kids looked just like my kids. They were the same ages, just sounded so similar. So I started calling my friends and I said, you know, this is going to sound kind of crazy, but I think we should do a march on Washington.
So she started reaching out to other moms, and they got a permit to march on the mall in Washington, D.C. As word spread, the movement quickly mushroomed, and on Mother's Day of 2000, hundreds of thousands of people gathered to demand stricter gun laws.
Mothers across the country are mobilizing to form the Million Mom March.
Calling on lawmakers in Washington to stand up to the influence of the gun lobby.
The group's target date for Congress to enact new legislation is exactly 9 months from today.
Mothers who lost their children spoke to the crowd. So did survivors of gun violence. And celebrities like Reese Witherspoon, Courtney Love, and Rosie O'Donnell.
The fact is, there are 750,000 people here. Across America, mothers and others standing together, giving birth to a movement. We want sensible gun control legislation. We are the voice of the majority of Americans. It is time we were heard.
Mindy Finkelstein also spoke at the march. She was a counselor at the Jewish day camp in Granada Hills when a white supremacist opened fire, wounding her and 2 other children. For her, the experience of going to Washington, D.C. and being thrust into the spotlight was jarring.
I got there and my dad decided he wanted to be backstage with me because I needed a parent or guardian with me. And I'll never forget walking backstage and it being just filled with celebrities. I remember meeting Reese Witherspoon and Susan Sarandon and Rosie O'Donnell and like all these people. And I was just like, oh, my God, what am I doing here? This is bizarre. And my dad and I just were laughing. It was like weirdly fun. And it didn't hit me how big it was until my dad said, hey, there's a camera stand. Why don't we go stand on top of it so you can get a better picture of the amount of people you're going to have to speak in front of? I don't know why he thought that was a good idea, because when I got up there, and I mean, from what I know, it was 750,000 people. So I got up there and I was like, okay, I'm going to go throw up now. And I did.
Mindy was invited to the White House that day. President Clinton gave a speech on the lawn. The sun was shining. Women in matching t-shirts surrounded the president. Everyone was smiling. The tone of Clinton's speech was hopeful, almost triumphant, linking the fight for stricter gun control laws with the civil rights movement.
Don't be deterred by the intimidation. Don't be deterred by the screaming. Don't be deterred by the political mountain you have to climb. You just remember this. When everybody thinks about this, and once they think about it, they decide to vote on what they think, you will have changed America. In the great tradition that runs from Seneca Falls to Selma, you will have redeemed the promise of freedom. You will have strengthened the bonds of community. You will have proved that the American Constitution works because decent people can stand against mountains of power and move those mountains for the betterment of their children. That's what you're doing. God bless you, and thank you.
In addition to the National Mall in Washington, packed with people that day, there were over 40 smaller protests across the country.
So really, in aggregate, there were a million people protesting in the United States in May of 2000 for stronger gun laws.
Lauren Lieb is the mother of Josh Stepakoff, who was 6 years old when he was shot multiple times at the JCC in Granada Hills. Both Josh and his mother traveled to D.C. for the Million Mom March. She says the experience changed her life.
Knowing that the shooting at the Jewish Community Center, where my son got shot, was the impetus for starting that march. So it was very moving. Yeah, it was amazing.
Did it feel like things were going to change?
I think we all very naively thought that America had spoken, the people had spoken, and we were demanding change. And I think we all expected that there was going to be immediate change.
But a million people marching in the streets did not create immediate change. In fact, since then, mass shootings have only increased in frequency and scale.
In Orlando, Florida, a massacre in a gay nightclub.
Reports of an active shooter in San Bernardino, California.
These are all shooting victims massacred in church.
Concert-goers last night in Las Vegas, it was a night of horror. It's the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history.
For many years, with every massacre, there's been a feeling of despair and loss. But for gun control activists, also an opposite reaction of hope. That finally this will be the mass shooting where the country says enough is enough. That was especially true after the 2012 shooting in Newtown, Connecticut at Sandy Hook Elementary. 20 little kids were killed.
Reports of a shooting where
gunfire aimed at elementary school children.
We heard racket in our classroom.
It was an almost unimaginable scene.
Chaos. Complete chaos. Nobody knew where anyone was. It was a mob scene.
Many of the people pushing for gun control since Columbine felt that the senseless and preventable killing of elementary school children would surely be the tipping point that finally led to new gun laws. President Obama was visibly shaken at the event and vowed to fight for stricter gun control laws.
Unalienable right to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, those rights were stripped from college kids in Blacksburg and Santa Barbara and from high schoolers at Columbine and from first graders in Newtown. First graders. Every time I think about those kids, it gets me mad. And by the way, it happens on the streets of Chicago every day.
There was no meaningful gun legislation from Congress following the Newtown shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary. The federal assault weapons ban that the Senate passed and President Clinton signed into law in 1994 expired, and no new legislation replaced it. But gun control activists have had some success. Chris Brown is president of the Brady Campaign, a nonprofit that advocates for gun control. She was also at the Million Mom March. Her mother brought her there when she was a kid.
I think probably those who participated would have liked to have seen more aggressive action by Congress to address this issue. But that does not mean that in the 20 years since that march occurred, there hasn't been significant change. There has. Most of it has happened at the state level. I credit the Million Mom March for really sparking the huge grassroots movement that followed that allowed states across this country to actually expand the background check system. And there are many other measures across the country that states have enacted to actually make their citizenry safer.
And recently, a new generation of activists are pushing for gun control. On Valentine's Day of last year, a 19-year-old expelled student from Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, returned to his school with an AR-15 semi-automatic, killing 17 people. And much like the Granada Hills shooting nearly 20 years earlier, activists organized a march on Washington. This time, it was led mostly by young people, weary of school shootings. They called it the March for Our Lives. Emma Gonzalez, one of the survivors of the Stoneman Douglas shooting, spoke at the march.
In a little over 6 minutes, 17 of our friends were taken from us, 15 were injured, and everyone, absolutely everyone, in the Douglas community was forever altered.
The March for Our Lives was one of the largest protests in American history. It's estimated that as many as 2 million people took to the streets, roughly double the number who attended the Million Mom March. And people like Chris Brown, again, started to hope that maybe this was the tipping point.
What happened is the young people in forming this march said very clearly, enough, and their sights were on, I think, a very appropriate event to make the change, which is the elections. Everyone became very, very focused on the election in 2018, and that is how we delivered, for the first time in a long time, a gun violence prevention majority in the House of Representatives.
The Democrats who now control the House of Representatives are already making good on their campaign promises to introduce gun control legislation. Yesterday, the House Judiciary Committee held a 10-hour hearing on a bill to require background checks for all sales and transfer of firearms. Democrats will also introduce bills to ban high-capacity magazines like the ones used in the Parkland shooting, and to allow temporary removal of guns from people deemed dangerous. But for any of those measures to become law, they would have to pass the Senate and be signed by President Trump. When Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was asked if any gun control legislation would pass in the Republican-controlled Senate, he said it was, quote, highly unlikely. For KCRW, I'm David Weinberg.
Coming up, why school lockdown drills don't really work and can actually be harmful to kids. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's been a year since a gunman killed 17 people and wounded 17 others at the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. We are continuing our conversation today about mass shootings. We're going to talk now about school shooting drills. Here's an example of one.
In Vader and school, lockdown procedures now in effect.
I repeat, lockdown procedures now in effect.
Shooter!
Okay, that's from an active shooter training video in New Jersey. These drills are supposed to prepare students, just in case the worst happens. But more educators and psychologists argue now that these drills aren't effective and they can traumatize students. We're going to talk about this now with Sarah Daly, professor at St. Vincent College in Pennsylvania. She focuses on school violence and mass shootings. Hi.
Hi there, how are you?
Great, thanks. And also joining us, James Allen Fox. He's a professor of criminology, law, and public policy at Northeastern University in Boston. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Sarah, let's begin with you. Before you became a college professor, you were a high school teacher in New Jersey. Was that the kind of drill that you would have in your school?
Our drills varied a little bit. When they announced them on the loudspeakers, they had a specific code word, and students were instructed to kind of followed the procedures and sit and hide. We never had the mock gunshots, and to be quite frank, I'm glad that we didn't.
Yeah, because that would seem pretty scary for the kids, right?
It absolutely would be. You know, I worked with high school students, but many of them lived in kind of an urban area, violent urban area. So I think the sound of gunshots could have been especially traumatic for them. And for other students that didn't live in urban areas, the sound of gunfire is still alarming to a lot of people, even if it's simulated.
Right. And James, is that a problem that you have with these school shooting drills?
Absolutely. They scare more than they prepare. And there's no evidence that kids will remember the lessons in the event of the real thing when adrenaline is pumping. I also have a problem with schools that do them on an unannounced basis. That could happen at any point in time. In fact, at Parkland last year, on Valentine's Day, when the shooting occurred, they had had unannounced drills previously, and many of the teachers were confused. They thought it was a drill. They weren't really sure whether it was the real thing. Mm. You know, if I may liken it to, you know, we go on an airplane. There's a certain chance of a crash in an airplane, but we don't go through a drill. We just assume that the crew has been trained, and we'll listen up if something bad happens. And that's really what should happen in schools. Train the teachers, train the administrators, train the cops. Leave the children out of it and just tell them if something bad happens, listen to an adult.
Yeah, and speaking of Parkland, there's some reporting that the shooter knew the drills. Like, the drills actually helped him plan his moves, which, Sarah, sounds incredibly eerie. So he actually learned from these drills what to do and how students were sheltering so that he could go in and shoot them and target them.
Absolutely. So depending on the school's choice of plan, whether it's sit and hide or kind of a run, fight, and hide or hide model, the students are aware of this. And if a student plans to or wants to perpetrate an attack at the school, they're going to be privy to all these plans. So we can't discount the notion that we're essentially giving away the game plan so that people can be better at doing what they want to do.
And are most shooters from the schools that they target, most school shooters?
Slightly more than half are, but many of them are former students, even many years former students. Schools represent, for someone angry with society, a place where they can get revenge against our society, where we are most vulnerable, where we're hurt the most. Let me say one more thing, though, about these drills and the potential perpetrators. Not only is it possible that a potential perpetrator can learn the routes and how best to beat the system, but also just the drama of the drill can be invigorating for the few students who would love to see a school shooting in their school, so long as they were in the back end of the gun. So many kids are traumatized, but a few find it extremely exciting, and I think that's problematic.
Well, and then does that then give them the idea that they should go ahead and do it?
Well, I think we do a lot, unfortunately, in our over-response to a very low risk of fueling the contagion effect. We're constantly obsessing over school shootings and school violence and surrounding our kids with armed guards and doing these drills. It sends a message to kids that the bad guy's out to get you. You've got a bullseye on your back. After all, we wouldn't be doing all this stuff if you weren't in danger. So I think it sends the wrong message to kids. Schools are safe. In fact, for many kids, it's safer than any place else they can be, even their home.
I want to play a clip of tape from March of last year. This is from a Pennsylvania House Education Committee hearing. Sarah, you were sitting right there next to the speaker. I just want to play what he says. This is the superintendent of the Blue Mountain School District in Pennsylvania.
Every classroom has been equipped with a 5-gallon bucket full of Riverstone. If an armed intruder attempts to gain entrance to any of our classrooms, they will face a classroom full of students armed with rocks, and they will be stoned.
Sarah, is that for real?
It is for real. It elicited a lot of kind of laughs at the hearing among state-level politicians. And to me, it was, I understand the intent. You know, they were trying to have a deterrent effect, saying that you're not going to be successful because children are going to be throwing rocks at you. But really, I think that's missing the major point here. And I fail to see how rocks are any deterrent, really, against someone with a gun.
What do you think is the best deterrent?
I think the best deterrent is prevention. You know, identifying warning signs, which are common. We see that Many school shooters had told people about what they planned to do, identifying children who are at risk, and just having more eyes in the school and providing more services, because that, to me, addresses the problem before you need to start throwing rocks at them or having armed guards.
What that requires, by the way, is money. We should not be spending money on hiring ex-military as guardians. We should not be spending money on high-tech surveillance systems. We should be spending money on more teachers and guidance counselors and psychologists who will get to know the students and thus be able to identify them. You can't identify a potential school shooter with a checklist, with a list of warning signs. That doesn't work because they're rare events. But you can if you have teachers who get to know the students well enough so they know when there's an issue going on, for example, in their household.
Okay, but let's say there is a school shooter on campus. Should the teachers themselves be the ones who are trained and go through these drills so that they know what to do, where to put the kids, herd the kids, whether they should turn the lights out, whatever? Who should be trained in case there is an active shooter on campus?
Well, I think the teachers absolutely, and the faculty and the administrators and the local police, so they can respond. There's other things we can do. For example, I'm all in favor of unobtrusive security measures that are not in your face, designed with such things as bullet-resistant glass or landscaping that would create a natural barrier. So it protects kids without giving that message of danger. Or, for example, some schools have these acoustic sensors that are so tiny, kids don't even know they're there. But if there is a shooting, it immediately alerts the local police, not just the fact that there's a shooting on campus, but where exactly in the school that shooter is. Because often happens when the first responders get to a big high school where there's a shooting, they don't know where the guy is. That's the right approach.
Right.
Low-key.
Low-key. Sarah, you've done a lot of research on this, on the profile of mass shooters. We need to keep in mind, right, that school, by and large, is a very safe place. Like, there aren't a lot of school shootings.
Absolutely. School deaths are still rare. As Dr. Fox said, it's often safer than the neighborhood where children live,
right,
or at home. And just to kind of build on what he said before is that there's a lot of time in schools where there are not children there. There's time after school or on weekends when law enforcement can go in, be familiar with the, familiarize themselves with the school and the layout. You can prepare teachers without having children there because teachers are more equipped to understand what's happening than children. So there's a lot of time for preparation and collaboration when the school is empty and when we're not going to potentially traumatize kids, which could have negative effects on their learning and their development.
You know, at my university, Northeastern, we have drills once a year on Columbus Day when there's no classes. The students aren't there. It's a training exercise involving some administrators, the campus police, and the city police. That's the right way to go.
Hmm. Okay, so if that's the right way to go, why is it that all these schools are doing it this way if experts such as yourself are questioning the value of these drills?
Because parents yell louder and pressure school administrators louder.
So the parents want them.
Absolutely. But they wouldn't want them in their own workplace. The interesting thing is these same parents who want their kids to go to school in a fortress-like environment with armed guards, they wouldn't want them work, have that in their office building.
But what if there's a parent, what if a parent is listening to this and is saying, you know what, I don't want this to happen. Can they pull their kid out of the classroom or can they say, I don't want my kid to participate in this because it's traumatizing?
Well, some schools that used announced drills do alert parents when they occur and permit them to keep their kid home that day.
Hmm. Sarah, do you think that's a good idea?
I absolutely do. You know, and I think part of it is kind of informing parents about the things that we know, what the research says about target hardening and security measures and what the effects are on children. I think it's a very natural instinct for parents to want to protect their children, and I don't fault them for that. But I think we as researchers need to do a better job of getting that information out there and saying, here are the best options. This is what we can do, working with schools so that they're not just working in isolation. This is not one school's job to fix or prevent. It's really everybody's issue.
You know, part of the problem is we constantly hear in the media that school violence and school shootings are up. They are not. There are actually fewer now than there were like in the late 1990s. The risk, you know, we're talking about 55 million school children. On an average, about 6 are killed each year by gunfire. It's not an epidemic, and it's not growing. The only thing that's growing is the fear and the over-response.
And so when we have anniversaries like Parkland, it sort of refocuses the attention on this. Do you think that the media is doing a disservice by focusing on it?
Well, on an anniversary like this, yes, you should. It's the right thing to do. But the rest of the year, I think we do obsess over it. We obsess over the risks, constantly talking about it. It elevates fears. It doesn't alleviate them.
James Allen Fox, he's a professor of criminology, law, and public policy at Northeastern University in Boston. Sarah Daly, professor at St. Vincent College in Pennsylvania. She focuses on school violence and mass shootings there. I want to thank you both very much.
Thank
My
you.
Pleasure.
Coming up, how an indigenous tribe in Colombia got involved in drug smuggling.
This hasn't been about the glorification of criminals. It hasn't been about gangsters being cool. It's been a process of the destruction of the basis of our society. And this is something that you never see in the narratives that are told from outside.
A conversation with the directors of the film Birds of Passage, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's a story you've probably heard before. A man enters the drug trade only to have the business and its riches tear his family apart. But Birds of Passage is not your Godfather. It's not your Narcos. It is set at the birth of the Colombian drug trade in the late 1960s, and it follows an indigenous family that begins to lose its identity when it enters the weed trafficking business. Birds of Passage was an official selection for last year's Cannes Film Festival, and it just played at Sundance, and it opens in L.A. this Friday. Christina Gallego and Ciro Guerra co-directed the film, and they're with me now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much for your invitation.
Well, it's great to have you both. This is an indigenous tribe in northern Colombia. They're called the Wayuu. Tell us more about them. This is an actual tribe that exists, correct?
Yeah. We don't have that much imagination. Yes, the Wayuu are the largest indigenous group in Colombia. They're about 250,000 people, and they live in the northern tip of South America, in the border between Colombia and Venezuela. And it's a desert place. It's called the Guajira Desert. And this is a society that has lived there for thousands of years. And it's a very interesting society. You have never seen them before. They're very colorful, and they were the first ones to sell marijuana to Americans. And it's a very fascinating story of the arrival of modern capitalism in its most savage form to a very traditional society that was not ready for it.
And this is pre-Pablo Escobar, because that's the name we most associate with the drug trade in Colombia.
Yeah, it's before all that. The story that you've heard is what happened in the 80s. But the setup for what became the cocaine trade was the marijuana trade.
Yes, I think that we had the feeling that we already know the history of Pablo Escobar from many sides. There's a lot of films and TV movies, but about what was the starting and about how we feel about it, no, with mm-hmm. this sense of tragedy that was for our nation, for our culture, for our families, for our traditions. We had the feeling that that wasn't represented. So that was the reason why we want to work with a traditional society that is corrupted by the capitalism or by the power or by the arrival of this amount of money and violence.
So almost the drug trade is a stand-in for larger issues of colonialism, of modernization, of just, as you say, capitalism. It could have been anything, but it was the drug trade, which I guess encapsulates that in such a pure essence, right?
Yes. It could be anything. It could be in way of marijuana or cocaine, or just the arrival of money, or just the arrival of power, or just the arrival of fame. Mm-hmm. No, there's this thing that arrives to a family, a traditional place, and destroys themselves from inside.
So the woman at the center of your movie is this matriarch. Mm-hmm. She's the mother of the young woman who is about to get married to this young guy who needs to get money for the dowry, and so that's how he gets into the drug business. This woman, though, she's the one who controls the whole family, right, and the drug dealing. Can you talk about her character?
Yes, sir. She's called Ursula, and she's a Wayuu woman, which is essentially a figure of power. Wayuu society is very interesting in that it's matrilineal. You can only be a Wayuu if your mother was Wayuu. You inherit your mother's last name. The mother's family is the one that surrounds you when you were born. And women have a very strong place in the society. They're the ones who are in charge of commerce, but they're also the ones who are in charge of the spiritual issues. All the shamans, the equivalent of shamans, are female, the ones who interpret the dreams. It's a society that has been built around the female power and the female point of view and the female understanding. So when we started hearing, this is a true story, of course, and we started hearing about everything that happened, it sounded like something right out of a gangster film, a mafia film. But the fact that it took place in this society where women are so powerful, it changed everything. And it takes this genre of films that you have seen, the crime drama, which has always been very around the male characters and also has been very machoistic and a bit of a celebration of violence. And it's an opportunity to twist it around and to give a completely new vision and a new perspective on the genre.
The movie is called Birds of Passage, and birds figure prominently in your movie. They seem to symbolize a lot. Mm-hmm. What is it for the Wayuu? Why is the bird a mythical character?
Yes. The birds are an essential part of Wayuu mythology. They are the creators of the worlds. They are the bringer of omens. They are the knowers of the future. And they are inspiration for their iconography. But also, you know, it's a title that has a lot of meaning in many ways. You know, it speaks of the migration of capitals, you know, and how these bonanzas suddenly erupt when a product emerges. And, you know, it's like a bunch of seasonal birds that come and go and they leave nothing behind. It also speaks to the transitory nature of human existence in a way.
And you two have worked together on previous movies, but this is, Christina, your first time directing. And so how did you make that leap from producing to directing, and why did you choose this film?
I think that maybe the film chose me. We were working together since 20 years.
Because you were married, right?
Yes, we were married. And we, as you grow up and you change your interests and all of this, and we met in the school when we were very young, and we all always have this creative partnership, but it was bigger in our previous film, in Embrace of the Serpent. And I think that my vision there gave me also the confidence to give the step and to be co-directing this film. And the issue or the thing that as we started the research, we knew that we can make a very unique film if we give this female perspective and this spiritual perspective, we can renew the genre, no? And will be something that it was more interesting for this film and for loyal with the history that we want to tell.
What is the motivation of the Wayuu in this to shed their traditions in a way, or at least to decide to get into this illegal drug trade? Why did they do it?
They used to be smugglers. This is something that they used to deal with everyone. They used to be smuggler with whiskey, with cigarettes, with clothes, and this...
Like contraband.
Yes. Uh-huh. And there's someone that arrives looking for marijuana, and they, we can bring it. And I think that this start of the history was from a very naive point, and they didn't knew what was going to happen after. They was just dealing with a product that they have in the nearby.
By naive, they didn't realize that this would lead to the destruction of their tribe or their way of life.
Yes. You have to understand that dealing with marijuana was illegal in the 60s. And marijuana was just another product. And there were people who wanted it. And so the Wayuu, they live in a desert, so they have very few ways of income. So since the time of the pirates, they have been dealing with whoever would come and whoever would need some sort of product. That's their trade. So marijuana was just another product, but then the demand for marijuana was so high and the prices were so unheard of that it was just an immense wealth that appeared out of nowhere. And it meant, of course, that a very traditional, very rural society is eventually thrown into modernity. Mm-hmm. And that sort of throws it out of what it used to be and into a new world in which there are no laws and no rules. And that brings up a lot of violence. And that's the way that we in Colombia have experienced what the drug trade has meant. It hasn't been about the glorification of criminals. It hasn't been about gangsters being cool. It's been a process of the destruction of the basis of our society. And this is something that you never see in the narratives that are told from outside. So it was important for us to bring you inside this process and what it means for us and from a Colombian perspective.
How did you come across this? Did you know about it growing up in Colombia, that the YU were part of this?
The story of the Bonanza Marimbera is sort of an urban legend in the northern part of Colombia. And, you know, if you do a little bit of research, you start hearing about it. But, of course, all the events that took place in the 1980s with Pablo Escobar and the drug cartels were such a big story around the world that this initial part has sort of been forgotten, even by Colombians. I personally knew about it, had heard about it some, but I didn't realize the scope of it or how interesting a story it was until we started doing a film 10 years ago in the same region. And people said, you know, in the 60s, this is what was happening. And it was just an incredible story. And it was incredible that it hadn't been told. So we went deeper and deeper. And the deeper we went, the more crazy the anecdotes were. You know, what you see in the film is really a small percentage of the stories that we were told and what we found in during our research. It's just it was a turning point for not only for our country, but for all of Latin America and eventually all the world.
Yes, and I think that we, as Hiro was saying, we grew up in the 80s. I grew up in the capital in Bogota, in a middle-class neighborhood. And I saw our neighborhoods becoming in the drug business and going up and down. For example, one neighbor who lives just in front of my house that was from the richest family of the neighborhood nowadays are homeless. Mm. So this is something that touched me directly because I was a child, but I was in the middle of this craziness thing that were happening outside.
And what's happened to the YU now?
After the marijuana became legal in many states in the United States, the demand descended drastically. So all the money that was coming in suddenly disappeared. And since it was wasted, you know, nothing good was made out of it. Most of the people that were involved in this marijuana trade went completely bankrupt. But the ones who weren't eventually got into politics, used that money to get into politics. And so a really corrupt establishment of politicians came to power and they started giving concessions to mining companies. And so after the marijuana was gone and the YU tried to recover from the violence, now they have to battle the mining companies who are taking the water. This is a desert region. So it's the water resource is very precious and very scarce. But the YU are really a people of survivors. They are the toughest people you'll ever meet. And they have always had to struggle against people coming from outside, even from the times of the conquistadors or the pirates, even the Colombian government. And they have never bowed down to anyone. But they still have to fight. And it's a struggle for them against the modern world.
But, I mean, in a sense, you can bet on their survival because they have faced long odds in the past, as you say, and they have survived. So.
Yes, and they are very, very strong. And I think that it's something that happened at the end of the marijuana bonanza was that they learn also from that and they keep away from that amount of also violence and even the Colombian government respect their own law and the figure of the war messenger and the deals between families and clans.
Well, I thank you both very much for coming in today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you. I hope everyone who is listening can go see the film when it is now being released around the United States.
Absolutely. That's Ciro Guerra and Cristina Gallego, directors of the Colombian film Birds of Passage. It opens here in L.A. this Friday. Coming up, getting ghosted by the Mars Opportunity rover. We still love him. Her? That's next on Press Play.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
How do I say goodbye to what we had?
NASA has said goodbye to the beloved Opportunity rover. And on this Valentine's Day, we're going to pay tribute to him since he was pretty much the perfect boyfriend. Reliable, committed, communicative. He helped us be better by teaching us more about our universe. Well, Opportunity first landed on Mars in 2004. It was supposed to be a brief romance, a flirtation, really, just 3 months. But it lasted 15 years. Abby Freeman is Deputy Project Scientist at JPL. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, do you miss him already? Also, yeah. Is he definitely a he? I mean,
Usually you refer to the rover as a she.
Oh.
But it's a robot, so you can say he or she.
Okay. So I guess that introduction was completely false. I should have said she was the perfect girlfriend because she kind of was. Because she lasted.
Yeah.
That lasted a long time. So seriously, it was supposed to be there only 3 months, right? How did it last so long?
Yeah, the mission was supposed to last for 90 days, but it was just a really well-made vehicle. You know, we took really good care of the batteries. The batteries are amazing. Even after 15 years, they were still operating at about 85%, much better than what your cell phone battery does. We also had a lot of help from Mars. We're solar paneled, and we charge our battery with solar energy. And eventually we thought the panels would get totally covered in dust, but Mars has had these wonderful winds that have cleaned off the panels every couple of months. So we've been able to just keep going and going.
Wow. And then what kind of data did you receive?
Lots and lots of science data. So Opportunity and her sister rover Spirit were basically our robot geologists on Mars. And what we did was we looked at the rocks. We looked at their texture, their chemistry. And all of these measurements help us understand how the rocks formed and how they changed over time.
And did you discover any water at all?
So no liquid water on Mars today, but what we found was that the rocks had fingerprints that showed that there was liquid water that interacted with them in the past. And because the mission lasted so long, we were able to look at rocks that were from many different times in Mars's history. And what we found was that water had been present over a long time in history, but it had changed. Way early in Mars's past, we think the water was kind of more neutral, more drinkable, and better for life. The younger rocks had interacted with water that was a lot more acidic, more like battery acid.
Hmm. So if there was water, when would that have been?
Probably between 3 and 4 billion years ago, maybe as young as 2 billion years ago.
As young as 2 billion years ago.
For geologists, it's still pretty old, but it's younger than 4 billion years
old. Wow. Okay. So with water, of course, you could have life. That's the question, right?
Right. So that's what we want to find out. For all of the life that we found on Earth, it can live in all sorts of extreme environments. But in every case, it needs access to liquid water. So that's kind of our key clue when we think of looking for life on Mars.
All right. So as you say, Spirit was there. Is Spirit gone too?
Yeah. So Spirit landed around the same time as Opportunity. But several years ago, she ended up getting stuck in some really soft sand, and she got stuck with her solar panels pointed away from the sun. And what happened was we just weren't able to extract her before winter hit and the sun got too low and we weren't able to get enough power. That was back in 2010, and the mission was declared over in 2011 after we spent some time trying to reestablish communication.
But meanwhile, Opportunity soldiered on. But when was the last time you heard from her?
So we haven't heard from Opportunity since last June. There was a big dust storm that hit her landing site and actually hit all of Mars. The entire planet became engulfed in this dust storm. This actually happens on Mars every few years, so it's not unexpected. And we've weathered dust storms in the past, but this one was particularly ferocious. The skies got historically dark, and we just weren't able to get enough power. So since then, we've been trying to reestablish contact. Once the sky is kind of cleared, it takes several weeks for these dust storms to settle down. And we were kind of hoping that there'd be enough power to hear from her. We were hoping winds might clean off some of the dust that settled on the panels, but it really seems like that hasn't happened.
Oh, that's so sad. So basically, yeah. That's the end of opportunity.
Yeah, so it's the end of the mission. You know, it's a bittersweet feeling. Because the mission's accomplished so much, it's hard to be sad for something that's lived 50 yeah. times longer than you thought it would. But it's still something we'll miss having in our lives every day.
But there's Curiosity, right? Curiosity rover is still there.
Yeah, Curiosity is doing great science. So Curiosity landed in 2012, a few years later. And Curiosity is a bigger, more complicated rover. And the reason we did that is because we could build on the questions that were answered by Spirit and Opportunity. So with Curiosity, we've moved beyond looking for liquid water in the past, and now we're looking for more evidence for habitable environments. So was that water drinkable? Were organic molecules, which are the building blocks of life, present? And to both of those questions, we've already found the answer was yes.
Oh my gosh, that's so exciting.
Yeah.
So is it your opinion, looking at all this, that there actually was life on Mars a long time ago?
You know, I'm honestly still not really sure. We haven't seen any proof that there was life. We just know that the conditions were ripe. We are going to be sending another rover in 2020, and we're sending that rover to a site that we're pretty confident if there ever was life on Mars, this is the kind of environment we'd find it in. And that rover is actually going to collect Martian rocks for eventual return to Earth. And then we're going to be able to analyze those rocks with the best instruments we have in our laboratories here on Earth. So hopefully that will be really able to answer the question.
And what's that rover's name?
Right now it's just called Mars 2020 because it's launching in 2020. But NASA is going to have a contest for students from around the country to send in their thoughts for what to name it.
Oh, fantastic. That's really great. And of course, it'll be another girl, right?
I think so. I'm not sure. You know, Spirit and Opportunity, they definitely feel like girls. People think Curiosity might be a boy, you know, because it's so much bigger and a little bit bossier. it's really interesting how we anthropomorphize these robots, but, you know, they really do start to feel like a colleague and a friend after spending so much time with them.
So as a scientist, you too anthropomorphize the robots? It's not just us?
Yeah, absolutely. I think everyone on the team does.
Okay. Abby Freeman, Deputy Project Scientist at JPL. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening. Happy Valentine's Day. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.